Healthcare Today is produced and paid for by the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to wdev@radiovermont.com.
Healthcare Today with Dr. Lewis Myers, a weekly exploration of health and wellness topics affecting Vermonters. Brought to you in part by Westview Meadows and the Gary Residence, retirement living the way it's meant to be. Age Well Vermont, the leading experts and advocates for older adults in northwestern Vermont. Northfield Pharmacy, pharmacy care with a personalized hometown touch. Northfieldpharmacy.com. And Kinney Drugs and KinneyDrugs.com, employee-owned and locally committed. Your participation is encouraged. Call with your questions, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255.
Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Lewis Myers, and this is Healthcare Today. I was away on vacation last week in Maine, and while it was a nice visit and some beautiful scenery, I'm always glad to return to Vermont and to this show. Today we're going to be talking about two important segments of our healthcare system. These are urgent care and occupational health. Our guest is Ms. Beth Schiller, who is a nurse practitioner who provides both the clinical services and is the director of the Champlain Medical Urgent Care in South Burlington. Ms. Schiller went to college at the university, graduated from the University of Vermont with a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering with a concentration in computer science. She then later went through the University of Vermont Accelerated Registered Nurse or RN program and later got her master's in science nursing from the University of Vermont. And welcome to the show, Ms. Schiller. Ms. Schiller, if you're there, welcome to the show.
Can you hear me?
I can now. Thank you.
Great. So
we're going to be talking about urgent care and occupational health, both of which you provide in your center. But I wanted to first talk to you about your daily commute, because I happen to know it's somewhat unusual. Could you describe how you get to work each day and get home?
Yeah, well, I actually live on the other side of the puddle, Lake Champlain, and live at a large farm that's complete with an airport. And typically, I fly to work instead of taking the ferry. And it takes a mere 8 minutes to get across the lake and land in Burlington, and then a five-minute travel to the office. So it's a unique way to start the day and to end the day.
So for those who might be stuck in traffic, land-based traffic, you can sort of fantasize about that kind of commute. So you have an actual airstrip right on your farm, is that right?
Yeah, I have an airstrip and a hangar. So for me, my airplane is very much like most people's cars. And just go out and pre-flight it and make sure everything's good to go, and then take off and immediately talk with the folks at the Burlington Airport.
Well, I imagine when you're heading home at the end of the day, you're going through your pre-flight checklist. It's a good way to sort of compartmentalize and put the day behind you.
It is. As we know, with the sun setting in the west, oftentimes the Adirondacks are just amazing.
Well, you do have a challenging job, because urgent care is at the forefront of a lot of healthcare today. And I wanted to talk about that. Could you just sort of begin by describing what is urgent care? Is there any sort of standard definition?
I don't think there's a standard definition, but I try to think of urgent care as not emergency care and not emergent care, but things that either could be taken place in a primary care provider setting, or perhaps just a little bit more. We take care of things, the typical illnesses, also the sprained ankles, people that cut themselves on zebra mussels in Lake Champlain. So we do a little bit more than some primary care offices do, but we're certainly not an emergency room. And so there's a fine distinction, and I think for individuals to think about whatever they're dealing with, is this a true emergency, or is this something that an urgent care might be able to help me with because perhaps they don't have a primary care, or if they do, there may not be an appointment to get in.
By the way, I want to let listeners know, as always, we're interested in your thoughts if you've had experiences in an urgent care or later as we talk about occupational health as well. We're at 802-244-1777. Again, that's 802-244-1777, and the phones are open. So we do see a lot of urgent cares here in Vermont, and, of course, wherever you go around the country now. Are they increasing in number in terms of the this part of our healthcare profession?
I do think they are increasing in number. One driver, I think, is it's increasingly difficult to get in with a primary care provider when it's something that is not a chronic condition but an acute condition. So that is driving things more into the urgent care setting. And it just gives people the ability to be able to go and get something done on the same day that they're experiencing whatever it is.
And tell me a little bit about your staff, not necessarily individual names, but when someone goes to an urgent care, what kind of staff might they expect to see in terms of the training?
So most urgent cares will have a cadre of physicians, which may be an MD, maybe a DO. They'll also probably see physician assistants or nurse practitioners. So it's kind of a mix. And frequently, urgent cares tend to have more physician assistants and nurse practitioners, and they may have a physician on staff for the harder cases.
Are there any certification standards? In other words, if you go to an urgent care, can you expect that they have met some kind of standard qualifications or inspections or whatever?
Not in urgent care. There aren't particular certifications, certainly in the NP or in the physician assistant route. And even in the physician route, it's typically not urgent care. If somebody's going to have a certification, it's going to be in emergency medicine.
Okay. And let's talk about some of the range of illnesses or injuries you treat, and maybe you could share with us some examples of some cases that you've seen in recent weeks or months.
So up until recently, it's been rather quiet with COVID, but as recently as the last 5 or 6 weeks, we're starting to see normal illnesses pre-COVID. We're starting to see strep throat, sinusitis. We're seeing people with lacerations because they're out and enjoying activities. We actually, sprained ankles are a big one too. We also are seeing people with back pain, some of which is musculoskeletal, although the other day I saw an individual who I actually sent forward to the emergency department who eventually the next day had neurosurgery because she had her spinal canal was being pushed upon so hard that they needed to actually relieve that compression. So it's really quite the gamut that we see.
Let's talk. You mentioned a couple of minutes ago about touched on the how do whether people go to emergency department, urgent care, or their primary care. If someone's at home and they start to feel ill or they've injured themselves, how should individuals decide whether to go to an urgent care? And I ask that because sometimes time is of the essence, and if they go to an urgent care and sometimes they can get the care they need, but if it's not the level of care, then there's been some time lost, perhaps. How should people think about where they should go?
I think, again, thinking along the lines of, is it a true emergency? Am I going to need lab work, imaging, to see specialists? That's when, you know, going to the emergency department makes a lot of sense. Now, we don't have any problem when somebody comes into our urgent care and we recognize usually pretty quickly that they need a higher level of care. One of the beauties is that instead of the individual walking into the emergency department cold with no information, we're going to send them over and we're going to call the emergency department and talk to the folks in triage to let them know who and what the issue is coming over to their facility so that we can prep them on what our concerns are and how to, in terms of starting to do the treatment and the diagnosing.
Right. So by the time it's not wasted time, in other words, you've already begun diagnosing the problem and also begun some initial treatments, I would imagine.
Yes, yes. Yeah, in the case of the individual the other day, actually provided her with an injection of a pretty strong anti-inflammatory to help her pain while she, you know, was in the waiting room, which fortunately wasn't very long over in the emergency department.
One of the things that impressed me was that during the COVID this past year, particularly before the vaccinations were widely used here in Vermont, many of the primary care offices were using telehealth almost exclusively, whereas I think the urgent cares stayed open.
Yes.
Obviously, that, you know, put some of your staff at increased risk, but nevertheless, I think it was an important option for people who were otherwise not able to actually see in person or be evaluated in person by a healthcare provider.
Right. Right. You know, a lot of what we do is talking to try to come up with differentials that make sense based on the symptoms and so on and so forth with patients. But there does come a time when being able to listen to lungs, being able to look into an ear, look at a throat, whatever it may be, where being in-house and being present is really helpful.
Well, I would agree, and I'm glad that we're most of the primary care offices now are back to full speed, and I think that that's important. Speaking of COVID, did you and do other urgent care centers do COVID testing?
So our particular facility, we were doing COVID testing for employers because the other piece of our business is occupational health. We were not really set up to for the masses of people that were coming through for COVID testing, and so we chose as a group, as a staff, not to do that, you know, put 50 people through the office just to do COVID testing. We did do some testing for employer groups where they were concerned that they had an outbreak and that and with contact tracing, we would do testing for them. But there was another urgent care not far away that was, there would be a line for 30 people at 8 in the morning.
And you mentioned that earlier that a lot of primary care offices have trouble getting people in on a same-day basis, and that's one of the reasons why people might go to urgent care. Primary care offices will also say, on the other hand, that that the urgent cares are sort of taking some of the easier, more quote-unquote easier, or more straightforward cases, which perhaps making income off of that and leaving the primary care offices to take care of some of the more complicated, difficult patients, which may be an appropriate use of services, but But there has been some concern about that. How would you respond?
You know, more and more I hear from the patients that come to see me that they can't get into their primary care for 2 or 3 weeks. I like to feel that we're working in concert with primary care. Many of the people that we're seeing do not have primary care. And, you know, either they're young enough, they're healthy, and so they really don't and haven't really gotten into the system. And so, or urgent care is their quote unquote primary care for the time being. So I would say, yeah, we do see urgent care that are established with primary care, but I would say that most of those individuals don't have the multiple chronic conditions. We see very, very few of the over 60 group. And again, it's when they can't get into their primary care in a timely manner, that's when they seek us out.
And I think it also needs to be noted that many, certainly very few internal medicine practices that I know of will do the kind of procedures that you do, such as suturing.
Right.
And some family practice obviously do, but urgent care is able to do those procedures. When someone comes to you, if they have a primary care provider, what about the communication between you and the primary care afterwards? Are you able to communicate with the primary care offices that so-and-so was in your office and this was the treatment?
So typically we don't actually send information along to primary care. If a patient wants a copy of their note, we're glad to give it to them so that they can have that copy and they can put that into their chart. For example, if we give them a tetanus shot or just here's the plan, and sometimes it'll be here's the plan, and if you're not better, you need to follow up with your primary care. So a lot of it is on the responsibility of the patient, because we don't cross over between our electronic health records and a big one that then transfers information back and forth.
If someone did not have a primary care provider and they were, it didn't look like they were going to be able to find one anytime soon, let's say someone came in with very elevated blood pressure, would you set up a follow-up appointment for them to be seen in your clinic?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, what we'll do and what I always say to people is, I know it might take 3 months to get into a primary care. Make the appointment, and we're happy to work with you until that time where you've got that appointment. Because oftentimes people say, oh, it's going to take me, you know, 3 months, 6 months to get in. And I said, well, if you don't make the phone call now and create the appointment, it'll just keep going on and on and on. Mm-hmm. And so with those folks, we are happy, and we do an awful lot of that in our occupational medicine realm when we do DOT physicals, when that may be the first time they've found out that they have high blood pressure or maybe even that they have diabetes. And so we are happy to work with the patient in conjunction with getting them established with primary care.
Let's talk about payment for urgent care. Who pays for urgent care, and is it less expensive than going to an emergency department?
Oh, absolutely. Urgent care is much, much less expensive from both, you know, a patient that needs to pay cash that doesn't have insurance to an insured patient. If you think about what's involved in terms of resources to staff that emergency department and the types of things that they need to be able to deal with, there's a huge overhead that obviously gets passed on to the patient, whether they have a stubbed toe or they can't breathe, okay? I mean, there's obviously extra things for the person that can't breathe, but the stubbed toe is still going to pay a huge amount going to the emergency department. At our facility, we are just like a primary care office in that we bill the same codes that primary care bills. So there's no extra facility fee. It just looks like a primary care visit.
So Medicare, Medicaid, and insurance would cover some of these services?
Yeah, so Medicare certainly and Medicaid would cover these services. And sometimes the patient has a higher copay when it's an urgent care visit versus a primary care visit. But it's nothing at all like an emergency department visit.
What would, in the few minutes we have left before our break, what would you say is the most challenging part of running an urgent care, because you're also the director, and what would you say are some of the rewards?
So the challenge sometimes is because we have some scheduled appointments, but otherwise we're primarily walk-in. The challenge is staffing, is having the right number of people. And, you know, some days we're really busy. Other days, during COVID, we were actually very unbusy. And trying to staff properly, making sure I've got individuals, since we're a private facility and we're not part of the university, sometimes it's a little bit more difficult to get professional staff, because of the benefits that the university can provide, that we can't always provide the same level of benefits. But, you know, it's so rewarding. The case I had the other day with that woman being able to steer her onto a better level of care, working with people. I met up with a gentleman who worked for Casella, and years ago he was just initially, I mean, we diagnosed him with diabetes, and it wasn't just a little diabetes. It was a pretty severe case of diabetes. And he really, really listened in and took everything to heart. And now he's in the last, well, after 6 months, he was totally under control with his diabetes. And it's just a wonderful thing to be able to go home at night knowing that you're helping people.
I believe you used work in primary care. Do you miss the ongoing contact relationships with patients?
You know, we do see some ongoing contact, because remember, some of those folks that are younger use us as primary care. Also, in the occupational space, we see people repeatedly, whether it's for designated exams or in the case of workplace injuries. So the contact piece, it's still there. It's not quite the same, but you do develop relationships with people.
So, Ms. Schiller, before we talked about occupational health, I did want to ask you, you have an interesting background. You majored in electrical engineering at the University of Vermont, computer sciences. What drew you toward nursing some years later?
So, initially, I was working as a manufacturing engineer at Digital Equipment in South Burlington, and unfortunately, in the late 80s, early 90s, digital disintegrated. And so then I started working for a software company that developed software for hospitals, an electronic health record, which was very early on in the early 90s. Really enjoyed doing that, and eventually ended up doing software consulting with hospitals. I joined my late husband in his practice for family medicine, and I spent so much time with patients and doing everything but diagnosing and treating. And so we decided, the two of us, that it would be great for me to go back to school, got my RN, and then continued on to get my nurse practitioner. And then I spent time in our own clinics, which were on the New York side, providing primary care to patients, rural, local people, and really getting to understand their needs and taking care of folks in that manner. And then we decided there was an opportunity to do more occupational medicine because there was only one facility in South Burlington. So we opened our facility up in 2012, and we've just been growing ever since.
Well, it has indeed. This is a bit off topic, but since you mentioned your background, electronic medical records, I'm interested in your thoughts. And we talked about that on this show with in a couple of other previous episodes about the effects of electronic medical records on healthcare, both good and bad. What is your perspective? I mean, are we using electronic medical records in a way that's helping providers and patients, or does it sometimes get in the way?
I think there's a little bit of both. I mean, certainly, rather than sifting through a bunch of papers in a folder to find information, the electronic record has is way better in terms of taking a look at trends and various things that we want to check off to make sure things are done. Those types of things are great. I do think that the folks that do the development of the electronic health records, there's not enough clinician time in that development, and so oftentimes it's not very user-friendly. People have to click a whole bunch of buttons, and they feel more like a secretary than they do a practitioner. So there's, you know, there's good things about it, and then there's bad things about it. Overall, I think there's more goodness than bad, but it definitely has changed the way medicine is practiced, and there is no going back.
Well, with your very interesting background, which incorporates some of both the technical and the clinical side, maybe your next challenge will be to develop your own electronic medical record company.
Yes.
And we'll have you on that to talk about that.
I'll let you know when that happens.
Let's talk for a few minutes here about occupational health. You mentioned that you became the second center to focus on occupational health. What is occupational health?
So occupational health is, I call it workplace medicine. It can vary from, as you know, everybody knows, if you get injured at work, that's one aspect of occupational medicine, where we take care of the injured worker. We also will work with the employer based on the injury to come up with a plan so that perhaps the injured worker is not doing their current job, but there may be an opportunity for them to do something else, even with their injury, just to make sure that their injury isn't worsened. So that's the workplace injuries. And then, as part of being in the United States, we have various regulatory agencies that want to make sure that employers are providing a safe working environment for employees. And so what that can mean is if you have, if your business requires your employees to wear respiratory masks, maybe they're working with asbestos or paints, or they may be in the construction business and they need to wear a respiratory mask, we need to make sure, and through OSHA, we need to make sure that, number one, the individual, the employee, is medically safe to wear a mask, because whenever you wear a mask, as many people have probably figured out this past year and a half, it reduces your air inflow. So we want to make sure people are medically safe to wear a mask. And then also, we want to make sure that mask fits them, because if it doesn't fit them, then it's useless. So there's the respiratory protection program, where anybody that needs to wear a respirator, whether it be half mask, full mask, your firefighters are wearing SCBA, we want to make sure that they are safe medically to be able to wear that mask. Other things like Department of Transportation, anybody that drives a commercial vehicle is required to have a physical at least every 2 years, and sometimes it's every 1 year. We want to make sure that the public is safe, and that we don't have, we mitigate any issues or potential issues regarding potential accidents as a result of a medical issue that the driver might have that is not being treated. And so Department of Transportation requires that individual drivers have a physical on a regular basis.
I believe in your center you also do flight physicals.
Yes,
and
we
you
do
treat
flight
the
physicals.
Air National Guard?
Yes, we do flight physicals. So pilots is another area of occupational medicine where our pilots that are flying for JetBlue and American Airlines, and then maybe they're flying for UPS, they all need to have what's called a first-class medical, meaning that up until they're age 40, they have that once a year. And then after age 40, every 6 months, they need to be reviewed by an aviation medical examiner. And then there's folks like myself. I just fly for fun as a third-class pilot, and I need to have an exam every 2 years to make sure that I'm medically fit to perform behind the yoke. So there's that. We also, other areas of occupational health would include a hearing conservation program. So if you have a manufacturing environment where employees are being, the noise levels throughout the day are very high and they're wearing hearing protection, one of the things that our government does is put together a program to make sure that that employee is not losing their hearing as a result of working in that facility. So we do all kinds of things like that, and we also do pre-employment physicals before somebody goes off to start a new job. We'll also look at when individuals have gotten hurt, whether it's on the job or off the job, when they're ready to come back to work, we'll do what's called a fit for duty, where we want to make sure that they can go back to their job and be able to perform that job.
It sounds like an occupational well, let me ask you this. Let me make it a more open-ended question. How is an occupational physical different than, say, a regular physical if someone just goes to their primary care provider?
So it's interesting you ask that because oftentimes people will say, well, can't you just do my physical at the same time for primary care? And occupational physicals are really looking to make sure you meet the minimum requirements. When we're doing an occupational physical, we're generally not talking about your family history. We're not talking about chronic conditions other than do they meet the requirements, and their past medical history and their immunizations and those types of things. We're talking about, does this individual meet the qualifications for this particular job or in the case of DOT?
You know, I've done just a few of these in the past when I was in primary care, and one of the things that struck me was that when people came in for these physicals, they were very anxious because basically it was a physical they had to pass or they were going to be taken off their job. How do you deal with that kind of sort of situational anxiety?
Yeah, well, we see that a lot. We see that with pilots, and we see that with drivers. And, you know, our philosophy at our facility is that we are here to help the individual. If we come up with a snafu that needs to be worked, as long as the employee is willing to work with us, we are willing to work with them. So if for example, they may have sleep apnea, we're willing to work with them and get them tested. We actually do home sleep tests because we found it was very difficult to get people into a lab. And so we'll work with them and help them help themselves so that they don't lose their certificate. And again, as long as they're willing to work with us, we try to give them the sense that we're there to work with them.
With these different occupations that you see, do you have to have an understanding of what the job is? Do you go out to a job site and sort of look at what people are doing?
Yeah, so we love to go to various manufacturing sites or fire departments. We had a tour over at the Air Guard Fire Department. We've gone on to Keurig and Autumn Harp and Twin Craft and, you know, a whole bunch of sites, because it gives us an idea when somebody comes in with a workplace injury, if we've seen the facility, their lingo, we may understand their lingo better with regards to the tools they're using, and also we have an image of what they're doing. So it helps us understand better the types of movements they're doing and what they can or can't do, and how we can, you know, create restrictions within the bounds of what they can do.
Sometimes some things get very specific. I remember one truck driver telling me that he did have more hearing loss in his left ear, and that this was not infrequent in truck drivers, because they would keep, if they kept their window open, they were exposed to a lot of noise coming in from the engines of the truck. So they tended to have more hearing loss in the left ear, something such as that.
Yes, yes, and we see that, and we also see sunburn on the left arm. But the good news for them is the DOT standards are such that as long as one of the two ears are working, they're good.
You mentioned going out to see the work site and trying to get qualified people to go back to work if they've been off of work. Is there sometimes a conflict, because you're contracting with the employer as well as treating the employee as well? So it's sort of, is there a conflict sometimes between satisfying both?
No, we really do try to work in unison together as a team. I consider what we do very similar. If you can imagine, like a pediatrician, right? A pediatrician has a child and has a parent. And we really try to mesh gears to make sure that, number one, the employee is being taken care of. And number two, working with the employer. And sometimes we need to educate the employer as to what issues there are and what they can and can't do. And sometimes, you know, the employee will come back and say, well, they're still having me do X. And so we're going to pick up the phone and talk to the employer and say, look, if you continue to have this individual do X, then they're going to have a harder time getting back to full recovery. And so it's a little give and take, but the folks that we work with, generally speaking, are happy to take input from us. In fact, the more the better in terms of what the restrictions are, so they have a better understanding and they can keep the individual productive, yet in a different environment.
It's somewhat similar to the role that team physicians have on professional sports teams or maybe the big college teams, where, you know, the team owners want the players back in the field, and the players may say that, you know, they're still injured. And it's certainly, there's some similarities there, I think.
Yep.
Do you notice a difference between, say, a national, I don't know if you have contracts with some big national companies versus Vermont companies in terms of your interactions with them
So, you know, a lot of our companies are local but nationally based. A lot of the trucking companies, if you find a good local representative to talk with, there's no issue at all. However, if we are working with a company where we don't have a good local presence contact, then it gets a little trickier. The same holds true for workers' compensation insurance. Sometimes we've got some really good dealings with some of those insurance carriers, because we need authorizations to have any imaging done or to send anybody to a specialist. But we try to make those connections. And once you've made those connections and developed a good rapport, everything goes a lot smoother.
One of the big issues now in occupational settings, of course, is COVID vaccination. Where there's some of the big companies and smaller companies and universities are requiring their employees and students to be vaccinated. Do you have any particular take on that?
I think it's up to the individual company, obviously. I'm strongly a proponent of vaccination. I think it's the best thing that we have right now, along with social distancing and just taking the normal precautions. So we probably will be going on site. We typically this time of year or another month or so, we start doing influenza vaccines on site at various companies. And it wouldn't surprise me if we have a dual use there where we might offer both COVID and influenza, although they usually are separated by a couple weeks.
If you're going to be giving the COVID vaccine, how do you do that with the Pfizer, which has to be frozen at extremely cold temperatures?
Right. So we would the one we would have is Moderna because of that issue. Yeah. And then what we would need to do is sort of really pre-plan for who wants it, because there is you have a window of opportunity to utilize as much of the vaccine as possible. It's a 10-dose vial, but I think you can get up to 14 doses out of it. So preparing ahead of time, finding out from companies, having people sign up, and then going on site makes the most sense. I wouldn't want to go on site and just wait for people to show up. It would be a really well-planned event.
I do hope people will get their influenza vaccines this fall. It is remarkable, though, that how little influenza we saw last year. I think almost none.
There was none.
Yeah,
we didn't see one in our clinic. And I do think that's because of social distancing,
sure.
People wearing masks.
Washing their hands more than usual.
Yeah, it just says something.
Yeah, it does. So in the few minutes we have left, because you strategize, I know, about healthcare and what directions it's going, what do you see as some of the biggest issues for our healthcare system? We do talk about this at times with some of our clinicians who are able to see the big picture.
Yeah, I think our biggest issue is primary care and not having sufficient primary care. It's really difficult for people coming out of medical school to pick primary care because there's so many other specialties that pay so much better. And when you have such a huge debt load when you come out of medical school, it's hard to be able to go into primary care knowing that's on your back. There needs to be more incentives for primary care, and I think we need to embrace primary care better than we have in the past, because that's where things start, and that's where the old-time country doc concept of taking care of people, learning about your people, spending time with your people is going to, at the end of the day, create a healthier environment.
Well, you've had experience in both. Do you see a way that perhaps an urgent care and a primary care office could join forces?
Yeah, you could have something like that. And this way, they're sort of still within the primary care setting, but get the actual urgent care needs within that setting.
And I have made the case in previous shows, but I would say that along with the fact that of the death that you mentioned in younger physicians coming out would be that primary care has gotten so very difficult in terms of the auxiliary work that has to be done that is not really patient-related. And one of the attractions, I guess, of urgent care is that it's not quite so paper or a documentation oriented.
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct. And, the other thing is we have actually started a model of what we call direct primary care, where we're working with, in this case, one particular company who many of their employees either don't have insurance or they have insurance with a very high deductible. And the owners of this company really want to help their employees have better health And so we've initiated a sort of a fee-for-service arrangement where there's no billing to insurance, which means there's no checking off boxes for insurance. And the individuals, once they come for a wellness exam and some basic labs, they have access to our facility for urgent care, primary care within the facility. And so we're trying that model, and I think it's going to work.
Well, I think it's a good model. We had Dr. Bruce Bullock on several months ago from the Rutland area who has a direct primary care practice. And, it's driven by the fact that there's so much of medicine has been overtaken by documentation and unnecessary paperwork. And this cuts, this allows people to spend more time with their patients. I want to thank you, Ms. Schiller, for coming on. I know that you have an extraordinarily busy life with your different practices and your primary care, and then, of course, flying back and forth over the lake. If people can wave to you at about 5:15, I guess, in the evening as you head back to Essex.
Right.
But thank you. I hope we'll have you on again. It's been very, very informative. Ms. Beth Schiller runs the Champlain Medical Urgent Care Center in South Burlington. I want to invite our listeners to join us next week. We're going to talk about advances in dentistry. We have professors and new practitioners from the Tufts Dental School in Boston, Massachusetts, and that should be interesting. Thanks again, Ms. Schiller. Thank you. Until next week, please be kind to yourselves and be kind to others.